From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm April Baer. Today, we meet the candidate elected to replace Justin Amash in Congress. Peter Meyer says he wants to spend the session getting back to basics.
I mean, let's anchor in what are some of those core uniting conservative principles. Principles like limited government, like economic freedom, like individual liberty.
Also, West Michigan's COVID spike.
We had, at the most, just over 80 inpatients that were positive for COVID-19 in the spring. Today we have 225.
Those numbers aren't on the way down. And today we try to come to terms with what just happened. Some perspective on a week of balloting and protest.
I take an offense to the fact that we believe that Detroiters can't decide an election, Philadelphians can't decide an election because they're Black.
What's the next step for healing the country? Those stories and more just ahead. Welcome to Stateside. I'm April Baer. Today on the show, two perspectives on the roller coaster ride that was the 2020 election season. But first, the next few weeks are extremely busy ones for everyone who was a victor on election night. Peter Meyer is getting ready to succeed Justin Amash in Congress, representing Michigan's 3rd District, which includes Grand Rapids and Battle Creek, of course, also towns like Ionia, Lowell, and Hastings. Peter Meyer, welcome to Stateside.
Thank you, April. Appreciate you having me on.
So, congratulations are in order.
Thank you.
So, tell us what you see as priorities for Michigan in general and specifically for West Michigan.
Yeah, I mean, I think in the broad sense, obviously, you know, that we've had very promising news this morning with Pfizer announcing some really strong efficacy in their latest trials for their coronavirus vaccine. But we're still going to be dealing with the economic consequences and fallout. So, you know, if there isn't a stimulus package or some other type of COVID relief passed between now and when the 117th Congress is seated on January 3rd, that's obviously going to be a priority. When it comes to West Michigan more specifically, obviously bipartisan initiatives like the PFAS Cleanup Act and the Watershed Health and Wellness Act are going to be very important as well. So those are things that we're monitoring very closely in addition to initiatives to increase rural broadband access. I know Representative Upton and Clyburn have sponsored a bipartisan bill, and the Department of Agriculture has already put forward $1 billion program in order to increase that. But that's something we need to make sure we see through to fruition to bridge the digital divide going forward. It's obviously of critical importance to students trying to deal with distance learning, and it will be critical to the economic recovery and vitality of our region going forward.
We just had an election in which Kent County, which makes up a significant part of the 3rd District, affirmed you as its next representative to Congress and also rejected Donald Trump in favor of Democrat Joe Biden. How do you interpret that ticket splitting?
Yeah, well, and one minor complication. So, you know, we have Kent County makes up about 2/3 of our district, and we have about 2/3 of Kent County within the district. So it's a little apples to oranges. But, you know, again, one of the things that we've always been talking about in our race has been trying to localize as much as possible, being able to speak to more local issues. But looking at the election results more broadly, you know, you kind of saw an affirmation for a bit of divided government. You know, it looks like the Republican Party is on track to hold the Senate. Obviously, we have some runoff elections in Georgia that look very interesting. But the Republican Party in the House was projected to lose anywhere from 5 to 15 seats. And now it looks like we'll gain at least 5 and are heading towards 10 or even more. I think it's hard to read any clear mandate coming out of the 2020 elections except for, you know, desire on behalf of the American people to have some degree of divided government and to work towards bipartisan solutions.
How has this election cycle affected your sense of yourself as a Republican?
Well, that's a degree of introspection we haven't had too much time for between the campaign victory and getting ready for orientation in Congress.
Well, I mean, just to unpack a bit, the head of the party has lost the election and he has yet to concede. And there are many voters in Michigan, Trump voters, who still believe the unsubstantiated claims that the presidential election was stolen. I just wondered how you interpret your responsibility as a Republican to voters who hold that belief, as well as to other people who may disagree.
Yeah. Where I've always come down is, you know, when you have when you have disagreements, when you have questions of definition and of party identity, you know, they can oftentimes get wrapped up in very, you know, emotional or relational subjects. And what I've always tried to do is step back from the feelings and go back to facts. And right, I mean, let's anchor in what are some of those core uniting conservative principles, principles like limited government, like economic freedom, like individual liberty, right? Distill an issue down to the core, to the basics, and then you can begin to at least chop through a lot of the noise, chop through a lot of the tension and a lot of that emotional reaction that I was talking earlier. I mean, to your point, it's going to be challenging. I think we are, you know, we're working through at the party level some of the allegations of irregularities. Now I'm waiting on some of those to be shown to be credible enough to justify a lot of the hope that's being placed in them. Obviously, you know, the certification of the election hasn't occurred yet. We've had you know, projections which seem overwhelmingly in line with what with where, you know, voting results are so far. But there's going to have to be some efforts, and you know, we're less than, you know, 72 hours out from the AP's projections, but we're going to have to be making efforts to unite, to kind of coalesce around some of those core principles, and also just kind of take stock of where we are and where we're going.
Are you in a place where you agree that Joe Biden is president-elect of the United States?
Yeah, I think that's the overwhelming consensus and odds. Again, you know, President Trump is also, you know, afforded his, he's afforded his day in court. And I think we need to make sure that if there are credible legal challenges, that they run their due recourse. But I think that's the overwhelming likelihood.
Let's talk about an issue that maybe your Democratic constituents care about, that maybe Republicans have been in disagreement on. It seems very likely that, you know, pending what happens in the Supreme Court, that there's going to be conversation in Congress about health care this term. And I know that you supported a Campaign for Liberty pledge to fully repeal Obamacare and oppose efforts to give the federal government more control of health care. How do you intend to position yourself in the coming debate, which, whether it happens sooner or later, is in all likelihood going to be a part of Congress's work this term?
You know, I'll say from the outset, referencing that pledge, I hate the yes, no, with no room for explanation, because every time, you know, I've spoken about the Affordable Care Act, and this has been one of my criticisms of my own party, you know, we talk too much about repeal without getting confidence in what the replacement's going to be. You know, so I would not support any repeal without ensuring that there's a workable replacement that first and foremost protects pre-existing conditions. But as a broad matter, you know, if you remember the origins of the Affordable Care Act, it was in, you know, Romney Care in Massachusetts. And there was a tangible difference between trying to seek improvements at the state level. And that Romney Care actually was spun out of a Heritage Foundation working paper. But a tangible difference between trying to seek solutions at the state level, where there still is the ability to have comparing and contrasting approaches and solutions from state to state, and one where we are nationalizing and going with the one size fits all approach. So I guess my frustration on the healthcare side is that the Affordable Care Act set out to do three things, the first two of which I agree with wholeheartedly: protecting pre-existing conditions and expanding access. But in that third component, and actually trying to live up to the goal of being affordable, what it did is it locked in a lot of the current profit motives and incentive drivers that have made the premiums continue to increase year over year, far outstripping inflation. They've done nothing to tap down on those exploding healthcare costs that are ultimately being borne by the taxpayer. This is something that we need to get right. We cannot be satisfied with having, you know, a slightly lower degree of overall outcome. And I'm not convinced that the best way to solve a problem is to give the government increasing control. I'm one that approaches government action with a degree of humility in terms of what we can expect the government to do, while at the same time recognizing that where we have seen the most efficient and improved outcomes has been with taking advantage of a profit-driven competitive enterprise. Now, that obviously needs to be governmental protections to prevent market distortions on the end. Without some degree of government involvement or mandate, you would not have protections for pre-existing conditions. So it's not an all or nothing approach. But again, it's taking an outcome-oriented mindset, and that's what we haven't had.
Joe Biden is arguably one of our most experienced people coming into the presidency in terms of foreign policy. I just wanted to ask what you think some of his priorities should be.
Well, I you know, as former Secretary of Defense under both the Bush and Obama administration said, I think Joe Biden's been wrong on every significant major foreign policy decision of the last 40 years. I think this is actually an area where President Trump deserves a lot of credit on some of the very unorthodox and innovative diplomacy that he's had in the Middle East with the signing of the Abraham Accords and a lot of, what seem to be incremental, but are really exponential opportunities to create stability in a region that has been all too volatile and frankly volatile because of a lot of U.S. intervention. I'm firmly opposed to the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan. I want to see those through to a conclusion. I've spent 3 years between the two conflicts, Iraq as a combatant with the U.S. Army and Afghanistan as a conflict analyst with the humanitarian aid community. So I hope that he continues that trajectory of withdrawal and resolution and also doesn't settle back into the same, kind of beltway groupthink that has really hampered and led to a lack of innovation in diplomatic efforts, over the past, 2 to 3 decades. Now, where there's some real opportunity in my mind is to reform the intelligence community so that the CIA is taking a far more strategic approach to get some discipline at the institutional level so that our strategic actors are not engaging too much on the tactical day to day, but are, doing their rightful job of equipping policymakers to go forward with the best information and decisions possible. Again, to lead from the front with diplomatic and intelligence efforts rather than having a military first approach that we've seen too often. And frankly, having Congress step up to the plate and recognize that the wars we're fighting are still being fought under authorizations for the use of military force that are almost old enough to vote. The 2003 authorization for the use of military force in Iraq and the 2001 post 9/11 authorization for use of military force have been stretched way beyond any conceivable definition that was intended at the time. But frankly, that's on Congress.
Well, Peter Meyer, congratulations again. And here's hoping the Minority Ginger Caucus welcomes you with open arms into the House.
With the loss of Joe Kennedy, it's getting smaller and smaller. But we will rebuild.
Tragic, tragic. Peter Meyer is representative-elect for Michigan's 3rd District. Take care.
Thank you, April.
Congressman Andy Levin, he knows something about court battles over elections. We'll talk to him in a moment. This is Stateside. I'm April Baer. The possibility of election challenges in Michigan seems much less likely now than it did last week. The Trump campaign filed a lawsuit in the Court of Claims last Wednesday to try and stop vote tabulation in Michigan. The suit was rejected for a lack of evidence that anything fraudulent was going on. But voters' sense of the election is still being shaped by this narrative. We should add a narrative without evidence that massive fraud happened here. Congressman Andy Levin worked on the Bush versus Gore legal case and recount in Florida in the year 2000, and we thought he might have some thoughts on this. Congressman Levin, welcome back to Stateside.
Hey, April. I guess that dates me, but
I'm old enough to remember it, too.
20 years later, and a completely different scenario.
What do you make of the Trump campaign lawsuits, both within Michigan and elsewhere, largely rejected on the state level?
I mean, gosh, April, anybody can file a lawsuit, but when there's no factual basis for it, it's going to get thrown out. And that's what's happened to these cases so far, virtually all of them.
Could you remind us about the role that you had in Bush v. Gore 20 years ago?
Sure. I spent almost the entire month of November down there. I was actually home here in Michigan campaigning. And then on Election Day, I went back to Washington. I was at the National AFL-CIO in those days. And then we got sent down to South Florida. I ran a phone bank of attorneys responding to citizens who felt like they'd been disenfranchised.
What went wrong for the Democratic Party that year?
Well, I mean, it was such a completely different situation, right? The votes were counted all across the country, and it came down to just a few hundred votes in Florida. And the Supreme Court ended up saying, stop the count, George Bush wins. And so it just is so different. I think that the Democratic Party should have continued organizing people, and it may have changed the whole atmosphere and changed the outcome. I just can't tell you, April. You know, I've been an organizer since I left college and went to work for SEIU in 1983, and I've never seen the level of unhappiness across many strata of society that I saw then.
Even compared with what we have seen in the past few days in Detroit, where Trump supporters, admittedly without evidence, showed up at the TCF Center, you know, shouting and banging on the windows, claiming that they felt that there was something fraudulent going on.
Yes, it's very different because, right, this is just conspiracy theories. I mean, you know, in Detroit, the TCF Center was full of Republican and Democratic and independent observers the whole time. All this, the talking points about it are ridiculous. For example, like that people weren't allowed in. Well, they weren't allowed in because there was already the full complement of observers in there, and so on and so forth. I mean, in Michigan in 2020, Joe Biden won the vote here by almost 15 times what Donald Trump won. Donald Trump won by 10,704 in 2016. Joe Biden won by 146 or 147,000. It just wasn't even all that close here. And I have to say, April, you know, the people who work on elections, yes, there's elected Secretary of State and the elected clerks in the cities and townships, but all the people in there, citizens, you know, maybe getting paid a couple hundred dollars or something, but they're basically volunteers who election after election come in out of a sense of patriotism to help count these votes. And there really isn't a scintilla of evidence that anything went wrong. In fact, I'm so proud of the Republican and Democratic clerks across the 9th District, you know, the ones I represent, who all did a wonderful job of making sure that every vote was counted correctly in this election. And the results will certainly stand, and President-elect Biden will take office, and you know, that's that.
The argument's been made that what's happening right now is not a true legal campaign being mounted by the Republican Party, but rather a publicity campaign on the part of Donald Trump to keep voters angry and engaged. And some Republicans have taken part in that, but not across the board. Do you see any hallmarks that distinguish? Do you see any difference between those two things?
Oh, yeah, it's tremendously different. And I think what will happen is that as the legal cases are shown to have no merit, more and more Republicans will separate off from this propaganda effort. I mean, you know, in Florida in the year 2000, there was a razor thin election. It was down to a few hundred votes. It was the only state, and it was determined, it would determine the outcome. If Gore won Florida, he would become president. If Bush won Florida, he would become president. So it was natural that you brought in all the lawyers and you said, hey, we want to make sure this is done right, without judging what happened, you know, what the Supreme Court did there. I think that it was quite legitimate for the two parties to kind of duke it out legally at that time. In here in November 2020, Joe Biden has won the presidency by well over 4 million votes and with a substantial Electoral College victory. And there is no story you can tell to suggest that there's any legal case that would change that. You'd have to think there's a conspiracy that crosses state, you know, multiple states, and involving thousands of people, you know, all these clerks sort of conspiring who don't know each other. And, you know, our elections, April, are so decentralized, and yet you'd have to think of some kind of big conspiracy. It's just, it doesn't stand up to the light of day.
Congressman Andy Levin, thank you so much for your time. We appreciate it.
Thanks, April. Take care of yourself.
You too. Kent County is seeing some of the highest increases in COVID cases in the state. Positive tests have been nearly 12% at their high point, and hospitalizations have also increased. Care centers in the Grand Rapids area are getting ready for the second surge. Mark Van Dyke is manager of business assurance for Spectrum Health. Mark, welcome back to Stateside.
Thanks for having me.
So tell us how different the situation looks today than it did with the state's first surge of cases in the spring.
April, if you remember, in the spring, the West Michigan area was relatively not impacted. We know we saw massive surges on the east side of the state. For example, we had at the most just over 80 inpatients at Spectrum Health hospitals that were positive for COVID-19 in the spring. Today, we have 225 positive patients. We are not seeing a decrease of that spike. And so obviously this time around, West Michigan is getting hit much harder. So it's a lot different for us.
Yeah. Where does that put Spectrum in terms of bed capacity? 225 cases.
Bed capacity is a really hard number to grasp. And I can tell you that we have 1,850 licensed beds within our health system. And this is one of the benefits of being a health system, is that we have the ability to flex those beds as we need to with our patient population. We don't have a set number of ICU beds that we can share, because we can move that number around depending on the situation, like we're seeing right now with our current COVID surge. We can take typical med-surg beds and units and turn them into ICU beds and vice versa, and really kind of flex our staffing and our number of beds available due to the situation. What I can tell you is that right now we are taking care of all of our patients within our four walls. We are not looking right now at expanding outside of those four walls, but we are shifting our resources around to make sure that we have enough space and staff to take care of the patients.
Kent County's health director, Adam London, said recently, quoting here, that the county is teetering on the edge of losing control of the virus. What does that mean for a hospital system? What do you need to handle a second surge?
Well, thankfully, we are in a lot better position to handle the surge than we were in the spring as well. If you remember back then, we had very little PPE. We didn't know much about the virus. We continued to understand what was going on in our community with what was social distancing, what was a mask mandate. Now we have a lot of opportunities that we didn't have back then. We are better clinically on taking care of these patients. Spectrum Health was just added into a research study, only one of two in the state, about Regeneron, and working with them on other pharmaceuticals that help these patients recover faster. We have ample supplies of PPE that we keep our staff safer while they're working. We know more about, as a community, social distancing, about wearing masks and how effective they are. And so it's hard for us as a health system to hear that we are on the brink. And it's really a challenging situation for us, because we know the surge is coming now. We're in it. But we also have the tools to respond to it a lot better.
I know that there had been some talk previously about opening some sort of surge location for extra beds, maybe at GVSU. Is that still a part of a possible plan?
Yeah. So when we talked in the spring, we actually had already set up Grand Valley State University's alternate care site. Right now, we have not set up any alternate care sites, but we are engaged in talking with our team members about what that would look like. Like I said, we right now are shifting our resources. We are doing all those things to take care of our patients in our four walls. But due to the situation, we are taking extra preparedness steps on what would an alternate care site look like, no matter what location that is.
Can I ask, what's changed in your understanding of what COVID care looks like that is not currently something that's waiting to be activated?
So I think in the spring, one of the big things we were worried about was the availability of PPE for our staff, the number of beds that were available and the number of staff in general that were available to take care of a surge. Today, we're better equipped. We're better equipped to take care of these patients within our four walls. We are faster reacting at adjusting our beds to make sure that they're at the right acuity, whether it's an ICU bed or not. We're better clinically, which means we're able to move patients out faster. And so all of those things kind of lean us towards making sure we can take care of our patients within our four walls. Now, be assured that if we need those external resources, we're going to be ready to pull that trigger and do it. The ACS, the alternate care site, is not just a Spectrum Health decision. That's a community decision. We're already in contact with the local hospitals, as well as people at the state level, to make sure that, you know, the data that we have is when it's going to be needed. We don't want to open an ACS just to open an ACS. We want an open ACS, our alternate care site, so because our community needs it. And we are strongly looking at all of that information. And when the time comes, we'll open the space needed to do so.
Which would you say is a bigger issue, space and equipment within care centers, or just having available workers?
It's definitely the fact that staffing is an issue right now. And I don't think that Spectrum Health is alone and understanding staffing issues across the board.
I should say the reason I ask you this is that we have heard from other hospitals that you can have all the ventilators and PPE in the world, but if you get to a point at a smaller hospital where your nursing staff has to quarantine or is positive, that can affect operations pretty drastically.
Yeah, I think every hospital is feeling the strain of staffing. And, you know, when we talk about community positivity, our staff members are part of that community. And so we know that staffing is an issue. And so as we go through these, the methodology of dealing with a pandemic, we have the staffing models, the Assistant Secretary of Preparedness and Response, as well as FEMA have issued guidance on what does disaster staffing look like from a hospital's perspective. And, you know, maybe that's the nurse taking care of one more patient than is typical, or a physician or a provider taking care of one more patient than is typical, to increase the capabilities of our staff.
Yeah. Realistically, do you think you would be able to pull in healthcare workers from other regions this winter? We did see when Detroit was getting hit hard, they were able to mobilize some stuff from other regions. But do you think that that would be an option, given that the surge is happening everywhere now?
It's possible. You know, in the spring, the east side of the state used one of four federally occupied or federally run staffing agencies that really staff ACSs or alternate care sites. And it's possible that we could lean on those agencies as well. And obviously that's a discussion that we need to have with the governor's office, with other state officials, with FEMA. That's not necessarily our call, but we would request that from our federal partners.
Yeah. You know, this issue of capacity, as you say, it's so elusive. And it feels like everyone these days has a friend or a family member who works in healthcare, who says that this hospital is full up or this one is getting close to capacity. Do you have some advice for the layperson on just interpreting what we're hearing?
So hospitals are always busy. And it's very tough to say that a hospital is at capacity or is overflowing. And when we hear that, you know, it's like, well, of course, it's Monday or it's Tuesday. It's a normal day. Hospitals don't usually try to keep empty beds and staff sitting around. We try to maximize our use and our helpfulness to the community. And so, you know, we agree that we are busier than normal right now. But what's important to really understand is that we can still take care of a patient who has a heart attack or a car accident or situations that, you know, need emergency care. This shouldn't be an opportunity to say that hospital is too busy. I read about that from a friend. It should be, if I need care, I'm still able to go to the hospital. Our standard staffed beds may be full, but that doesn't mean that we can't expand our standard staffing beds. We have the ability to adjust within to make sure that our community is safe and taken care of, whether they're a COVID patient or a non-COVID patient.
Yeah. The environment's highly politicized right now. We're just coming out of elections, and a lot of people are waking up to the fact that the second surge is here. How do you approach getting people to come together on the public health measures that are going to let the health system function at it as well as possible during a surge?
April, it's not about who you voted for. It's not about your political stances. The message that we try to convey is that we are all in this together. And we need people to wear masks. We need people to avoid social settings where they're too close or with a whole lot of people. We need people to use great hand hygiene, wash your hands frequently with soap and water or hand sanitizer. It's so important. None of us, including all of the healthcare workers, want to be shut down again. All of us want to be able to go to our favorite restaurants. All of us want to have our children in the schools. All of us want to be able to go to the store without arrows on the floor. But without some really simple measures of wearing a mask, washing your hands, increased social distancing, we know we may not get there quite yet. We are in a time where we need to work together. And it is unfortunate, and it's hard to hear the political nature of what this has become. Because the reality is, without all of us, this surge, whether it's this surge or the next surge, won't slow down.
Mark Van Dyke is manager of business assurance for Spectrum Health. Mark, thanks so much for your time.
Thanks, April.
Up next, two views from Oakland County of what happened on Election Day last week. That's next. Stay with us. This is Stateside. I'm April Baer. Can we take a moment to talk about what just happened? The election of 2020 held so many surprises and some serious shocks. On election night, Adam Kokenderfer was watching the results with as much, if not more, anticipation than anyone. He's a sitting commissioner for Oakland County and a Republican in a competitive election with Democrat Melanie Hartman. The results came in, and he lost. But a technical error changed the count in Kokenderfer's favor. By Friday, he was the returning commissioner-elect for Oakland County. Adam, welcome to Stateside.
Hi, April. How are you?
I'm all right. The error involved a set of absentee ballots that had been mislabeled. Can you tell us when you found out that the results of the election might have changed?
I did not find out until Thursday afternoon, maybe around 3 o'clock, I received a call from Oakland County Elections Division, Joe Rizzell.
What was running through your mind when he told you what had happened?
First, disbelief. I had lived with this belief that I had lost for over 24 hours. And then he simply said, there's an error. And it turns out that you won. And instead of losing by 104 votes, you won by over 1,100 votes. And I was just trying to wrap my brain around that reality and what it really meant for me and for the city and for the county.
Yeah, it's a lot. Just to put this in the words of the Free Press, what happened here was a Republican city clerk supervised the initial vote count of the ballots that turned out to be important. A Democratic county clerk's staff caught the error and requested the correction from the Republican city clerk, resulting in an election that appeared to have been won by a Democrat actually being won by a Republican. What does this tell you about how our voting process works?
Well, people are taking different takeaways from this, and some people have pointed to this and tried to tie this into a national narrative about issues with our election system. The other side is that it shows that there are safeguards in place. This mistake was caught at the end of the day. And so it's concerning that it took a while to update those numbers. I think we need to examine the system and make sure that this doesn't happen again. But the error was caught, and that's because we have people in place, and this is their job.
More broadly, what kind of mood did you find voters in this year?
I'll be honest with you, April. I didn't know what the top of the ticket would do to my individual race. Rochester and Rochester Hills is a changing community. And the fact of the matter is that a lot of the things that we do at a county level are not necessarily partisan or should not be partisan. And you go out there and you tout the real results that you've achieved for the community, but I didn't know what voters would do with that information. And I'm grateful that they chose to return me to office. But I came into this with eyes wide open, knowing that there were no guaranteed results here.
Preston Trump has spent some time this year insisting that there was election fraud in Michigan, and many of his supporters took his word on that. How do you interpret that widespread belief?
I'll say this. I'm not qualified to speak to all the issues happening across Michigan, but I can speak to my individual race. We have a highly credentialed clerk in Rochester Hills who is nationally recognized for her expertise. I've talked at length with her, with our elections division. I am confident that this was not an example of fraud and that it was an isolated error. That does not mean that fraud didn't happen elsewhere. I haven't seen hard proof for that or hard evidence, but I am convinced that there wasn't any foul play in this race.
Do you worry about the belief that some people have that election results can be undermined on such a widespread basis?
I think everybody needs to take a deep breath here. I mean, the fact of the matter is that as of right now, it appears that Joe Biden and Kamala Harris have won. And there is also a system in place for challenging those results. And President Trump and his team have the right to challenge those through legal processes. Thus far, I don't think that they've come forth with any hard proof, but it's their right to try to find that proof. And that's the process that we're in. Even if you're a Democrat, it is in your interest to have the Trump campaign go through that process. Once that process is complete, it is in the interest of every American to accept the result. We're Americans. We invented modern day democracy. We do this better than anyone else. And the world is watching, and we need to show that.
Is there anything that you wish people understood better about the political process and what it means to work together? You alluded to the fact that Oakland County has 21 members on the Board of Commissioners. What would you want people to know about what it means to work together?
So I've been in public office for over a decade now, April. In my experience, people agree on something like 80% of the issues, regardless of party. But we have political machinery. We have social media. We have news across the spectrum, and their survival depends on exploiting our divisions. But that laser focus on that remaining 20%, it oftentimes impedes our ability to develop and execute solutions related to that 80%. And I think, listen, we shouldn't ignore our disagreements, but I'm concerned that we're increasingly ignoring our agreements. And it's in all of our interests to not forget about all those things that we agree on, because in my experience, it's the vast majority.
What do you think this election season, if anything, do you think it will have any effect on how Oakland County does its business?
Listen, my glitch has raised a red flag of something that we need to look at and make sure that it doesn't happen again. But generally speaking, the system operated smoothly across the county. And as I said, even in my case, the safeguards worked. And so I applaud all the clerks across the county for the hard work that was done, all the poll workers in a very, very stressful environment. And there are a lot of things that went right here.
Adam Kokendorfer is a sitting commissioner for Oakland County, and he will be returning to that office next year. Adam, thank you so much for your time.
Thank you very much, April. I appreciate it. Have a good day.
If you get beneath the surface of Election Day, you find some different cross currents about what happened. Danielle North lives in West Bloomfield. She and her husband have three kids. She's a small business owner, and her experience of elections this year tells a different story. Danielle, welcome to Stateside.
Thank you for having me. It's a pleasure to be here.
So you're the proprietor of Kids Kingdom, which was Detroit's first indoor playground, right?
Yeah.
Could you tell us a little bit about your business and how the year's been going?
Sure. So we opened as the first indoor playground in May of 2016. And then subsequently, due to a need in the community and responding to some of the questions and feedback we got from customers, we became a licensed child care center in October of 2017. And we continue to operate as an indoor playground on the weekends only. And so who would have known that that shift would have not only saved us in 2017, but really, really saved us during this pandemic, because the indoor playground has not operated since March, but we've been back up and running as a child care center since July. And we've really been able to be an asset to our community, to our own children and our family. It's not just a business. It's kind of a community centerpiece and a story of triumph.
So Danielle, as if it weren't enough keeping a small business afloat and a small business that is going through a great deal of demand right now, I understand your family moved recently after you spent your whole life in Detroit.
Yeah, it's a major, major shift. So with the exception of going away to college and for a time when I was a child, when my father was in the military and I lived outside of the city of Detroit, I have spent, you know, my entire life in Detroit, my husband, his entire life, with the exception of going away to college for a bit. But we came to a place where financially and educationally for our children, it made the most sense to make this shift. And emotionally, it was very difficult for us because it's been a part of our narrative. And ultimately, it came down to us choosing West Bloomfield. We've been embraced by our community and our neighborhood and have found, you know, that they represent our values and beliefs. We've just been really, really, really happy. You know, we miss Detroit. If things would have been different, we would have stayed, but we don't regret our decision.
So with all this in mind, what would you say this year's election meant to you? How are you approaching it?
Wow. I guess I kind of approached it as a personal pursuit and a crusade to, you know, we say this isn't America. We say that the things that we've seen this year in their worst form are not America. But unfortunately, it is America. There are people in America who believe and think and uphold many of the practices that our outgoing president has really put into the atmosphere. But in bringing in a new president and vice president, it also shows that there are a great deal of Americans who don't believe and operate that way. I have not been teaching my children to hate or to say, you know, stereotypical statements about groups of people. But that's what we've been seeing. We've been seeing statements like, you know, Mexicans are going to come into our country and they're rapists. We've seen that, you know, more recently, cities like Detroit and Philadelphia should not be deciding our elections. That type of rhetoric, I think, is so dangerous. It's racist, it's inflammatory, and it incites hatred. Now, I don't believe that the government can save us, but I do believe that we need to have the people and policies in place that helps guide us into a brighter future.
You had not intended to be at the polls on Election Day. Can you explain how you got involved?
Well, I'm one of the many who was an absentee voter. So Election Day, I spent the day, you know, watching the news, waiting it out, being on social media, talking with friends anxiously. And at midnight, I received a clarion call from an individual who participates in my women's network who said, "Hey, can you talk? It's political. It's serious. Are you able to call me?" At midnight. And this is not someone who I regularly, well, we've never spoken on the phone. We've not met in person. But she thought that there was something that I could do about what was happening. And she told me 60 Republicans just showed up to the TCF Center and we need a balance of Democratic poll challengers to come down. I immediately reached out on social media to my women's network, and women literally just started flooding the polls. "I can come down there. I can do this. I can be there." you know, I have three children, so I couldn't make it until 11:45 the next day. So it was more of a slower actual election day. But what ensued the following day and really, you know, at midnight, it's what mm-hmm. took a drastic turn.
People at this point have seen some of the videos of election challengers who support President Trump and the things that they said to election workers and the shouting and some of the efforts to get inside the counting area. Was that consistent with what you saw?
It was and it wasn't. On one hand, what was happening outdoors was certainly much more radical than what was happening inside of the center where they were counting. You know, from the videos, you can see people banging on the doors. That happened. We could hear it and see it. Inside, ballot workers were working. It was primarily calm. But what was happening throughout the space, challengers were coming to the tables and they weren't loud or yelling, but they were saying things like, based upon pending litigation and due to the fact that others can't get in here, mind you, the space was full of Republicans. They had met their quota. So the workers didn't allow more people to come in. So they were there, they were challenging. They were saying, we want you to stop counting. They were clapping. There was a point where they were clapping and saying, stop the count, stop the count. So we had been trained to say, we will take note of your challenge. They will review the challenge, but they will not stop counting.
What is your takeaway about what just happened on Election Day in 2020? What are your thoughts about where there is to go from here?
I've been thinking about that. I'm inspired. I was very, very happy. You know, as a Black person in America, it means something to me to see brown children standing on that stage. And it means something to me to see families that you can identify with all and be relatable to on any level. You know, our incoming president, our president-elect, you know, has experienced loss. You know, his family has gone through things that everyday Americans experience in terms of, you know, addiction and being able to love your family through that. Kamala, for what it's worth, for people arguing what her background is or whatever, she is a woman of color. I can identify with that. And so that inspires me, that brings me hope. At the same time, I'm a little worried about what's next, because I honestly have felt like the Trump presidency was a direct challenge against us having 8 years of the first Black president, of having a very strong, educated, bright example for Americans. I am hopeful that now with Biden and Harris, we're going to go forward and not backwards again, but I don't have anything to go off of. So I'm equally concerned that we could backtrack.
I wonder where you come down on the distrust of the election system that a significant portion of Michigan's white electorate now has.
You know, I'll say this. When Trump won the last time, I was disappointed because I did vote for Hillary. But I never said they cheated. I never said the election was stolen. I accepted the results, although they were not the ones that I wanted. I think it is very, very disappointing. It is misleading and it is disgusting to say that our electorate process is not working. It's not real. I take an offense to the fact that we believe that Detroiters can't decide an election. Philadelphians can't decide an election because they're Black. And so to me, that's saying that they don't deserve the right to vote. And if you do vote, then we're going to invalidate that vote. And so I have faith in our process. I do believe that we had a fair election. And I just know that there are going to be millions of Americans out there who are going to believe otherwise. And all we can do is educate and try and turn those lies on their heads.
Danielle North, you've had such a crazy year. Thank you for taking a couple of minutes to talk to us. And we're hoping for calmer things for 2021 for you and your family.
Thank you, April. I appreciate the opportunity to speak on it.
And that's Stateside for today. Our show is produced by Mike Blank, April Van Buren, and by our director, Mercedes Mejia. Our executive producer is Laura Weber Davis. Stateside is a production of Michigan Radio, a broadcasting service of the University of Michigan. I'm April Baer. Thanks for listening. We'll see you tomorrow.